And I said that the most successful investors we see are action takers. They're doing it. So what is the difference? Like, why do you think some people have to spend so much time doing research and never take action versus those who, I mean, investing from Tel Aviv into a market you've never been in? And we have a lot of out-of-state investors that let us manage their properties that they've never even been to. So I get that. But what is the difference between just talking about it, doing all the research and never pulling the trigger, and those that pull the trigger?
I think it comes down to one thing, and that's fear. And fear can either paralyze you or it can either drive you to get better understanding.
All right, everybody, welcome back to another episode of the Birmingham Real Estate Investor Podcast. I am your host, Spencer Sutton, and I've got a special guest with me today. I've got Danny Bateor from simplydoit.net. And Danny, man, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Spencer. Thanks for having me. Much appreciated. I know this goes to a large crowd.
It does. We've got a great audience, and they're always interested to hear what's going on, not only in our local markets, but also around the country. So we're going to get into this. And I'm excited to get to know you better. I was doing some research, just reading a little bit about your background. And I know that you were in the Israeli Special Forces previously. You retired. So I want to talk about how that connects to your real estate investing. Yeah. But first of all, I do want to talk and find out just more about you. Our audience always loves to hear kind of the origin stories. Like, how did you get involved in real estate? Because I know you've been investing since around 2002, I think, and you've helped over 5,000 real estate investors along their own journey. So I would love just to hear the beginning.
With pleasure. I'm originally from Israel. I was, during my mandatory service, I decided to do it, you know, to the best of my abilities. And I joined the Special Forces unit, which I, great experience, very hard, very tough, very demanding on, you know, physical and mental, but very rewarding, especially in terms of the people that I call my buddies. You know, this is my brothers, you know, for life. And it sounds like what people always say, but my friends in Israel meet the team on a weekly basis. Right. We talk regularly. So this is an amazing experience. And it lasted. Boy, is it lasting a lifetime for us. After the military and after getting my engineering degree, I started working for the Israeli high-tech, some Israeli high-tech company. That company recently was purchased for $1.3 billion by Salesforce, maybe 2 years ago. I wish I can accredit some of that to me. I can't really. I wasn't there for a long time. But what happened when I was there, the interesting things that, you know, that the internal engine that was established or created there is very quickly. Here I am at the time, because everything is, you know, because of the military is a little bit late in Israel. I think it was 24, 25, starting my adult life, so to speak, after the military, after having my engineering degree, you know, first year into the job, I'm all in, kind of getting the wraps. And I honestly was good at my job because it was project management and it was challenging. But after a year, it wasn't as challenging as before. But I was good at my job and I had time. And I started looking around and asking myself, what the heck is going on here? Why, you know, is this what I'm looking for in the next 10, 15, 20 years of working hard? Israeli work culture around the high-tech industry is very demanding, long hours. Yes, a lot of flexibility, but very, very demanding in terms of the hours. And I thought, wait, I have my girlfriend at the time. We're married today. We're living together with, you know, we kind of know where the path for us is, kind of thinking about it. And I just could not accept the fact that this is it. Like, I'm going to work. And I was mainly looking at my older cousins, my uncles, my parents for 10, 15, 20 years, working hard hours, long hours, giving up a lot of family time and, you know, and stuff like that. And what do they have 10, 15, 20 years later? A condo with a mortgage. Right? And they're kind of struggling. They're not necessarily struggling in the sense of like being poor, but middle class. They're never, you know, my house, middle class, military career, my dad, my mom worked two jobs, no complaints. I love my childhood. I never felt something is missing. I don't think we were not poor, but we were never, you know, in a luxury life at my house, right? I mean, we had everything we needed, but there's never more than the basic, you know, necessities plus, let's just say. And that kind of stuck. And then the vision or the understanding or realization, the people around me are working so many hours for so many years and they barely have something to show for all that hard work for so many years. I didn't know what the answer is. I knew what I don't agree with. Like the right path that I was watching myself going, my friends, and seeing where it's leading, I just didn't agree with it. And what I did, it actually drove me to start searching, like a financial searching. I felt a little bit a young adult. I felt real life finances illiterate. So I started educating myself about different financial vehicles or different things in my financial world,
right,
compensation, worker compensation, this insurance, that insurance, this. And I got that covered within a year or two while I was working, kind of getting to know better. And that's okay. What's the next step? And the next step was start looking for investment. I think in a very comfortable kind of way, I started asking about stocks and option and investing in that. And I wasn't happy. I wasn't pleased with the risk reward that I was getting. It wasn't bad, but it didn't make any sense to me still. Mm-hmm. And while I was on this kind of search is a nice term, it was actually anywhere from a quest to a fetish. I don't know, because I was really on.
It was a journey. Yeah, you're on a quest. It was a journey.
It wasn't like, let's just read here and there. I was on a quest. That's probably the right term. Because I told myself, you cannot live life as an adult with, you know, this stuff and like just the basic not knowing. Mm-hmm. And that eventually led me, while I'm still in Tel Aviv, to learn about U.S. real estate investment. So here I am, young guy in Tel Aviv, 2000-ish. Mm-hmm. Nobody's talking about U.S. investing in real estate. And I heard about it. I went to see a lecture. When I was there, I'm like, okay, this makes perfect sense to me. But what do I know? Completely insecure. No one around me, you know, is doing it. There's nobody really to talk to about. There's no forums, Facebook groups, stuff like that. You know, it's right. The internet is around, but it's really in the 1.0, so to speak, era, right? Or maybe just.
I remember.
Yeah. So Google was a startup. Google was a startup. Let's just face it, right? Facebook was not even an idea. So not all the resources that we have today, with some of us take for granted, were not there. And I had to work hard and kind of trying to make a decision. And I went in and listened to another lecture and read online what I could. And then I told myself, you know, after maybe a year of kind of digesting it, I had a conversation with myself and I just asked myself, are you a talker or are you a walker? Mm. That was the conversation. I said, I'm a walker. And I actually went and purchased my first rental property in a tiny town that nobody knows where it is. It's called Phoenix, Arizona. I'm sure you never heard of it.
Never heard of it, right.
Honestly, I got to say, I went to high school in the U.S. for 2 years with my dad's, you know, military assignment for 2 years in Washington, D.C. Mm-hmm. And that kind of gave me a little bit of maybe opened my eyes towards the U.S., right? So it wasn't completely strange. I heard the name Phoenix. I didn't know where it is. Luckily, Google Maps were not around, but MapQuest was,
yeah.
Exactly. And I looked it up. I saw where it is. I bought a nice house on a street called Honeysuckle, a cute neighborhood subdivision. You know the little boxes and they all look just the same, right? Yep. Every house on the street looks pretty much the same. That's very uniform community with the HOA from a builder in a good school district, like such a boring type of real estate, unbelievably boring. And it was great because I bought that house completely sight unseen, put money down from the, you know, to buy it, to reserve it basically.
Right.
And then they start building it. 6 months later, the house is ready. Never been to Phoenix, never seen the house. All remotely, no Zillow, no public records, no all this, you know, all this stuff, barely knowing what I do, very simplistic analysis. That house was purchased in 2002, closed in maybe 2003, and it got rented within 45 days. And that house was a really amazing experience for me because what that house did is, first of all, it was rented, I call it to my little zoo in Phoenix. It was rented to a family of six. Four kids and parents. And in 2004, when I moved to the States, my wife and I decided to move to the States. We moved to the States and I go and I travel, you know, from California, I'm going to see my house. I think, I can't remember if I was, you know what, for the first time, I went there when it was a lot. I actually flew from Israel eventually when I was under contract, but it was still a lot.
Right.
And now it's a house. You know, I'm a beginner investor. I already own this. I already did two other small investments, maybe bought another house by that time. And I come in, I was not happy because as soon as I come in, I noticed there are two dogs, hamster and a bunny in the house. That's why when I nicknamed it, my little zoo in Phoenix.
Right.
Now I have to tell you, my first gut reaction was like, what the heck is going on here? Right. How come I don't know about it? And this is not good. And that was like, but by that time, I think I already owned it maybe for 2 or 3 years, something around that. And I come back from my trip and I think about it, I say, wait, so there's a little zoo, four kids, four pets, the parents, they've only been late once or twice on rent, but everything else is just, and they've been there for a while. And that created, that zoo was very stable. And actually, if you really think about it, if you run such a zoo as a parent and you're late only twice on your rent in multiple years, that's impressive.
That is impressive.
It's not that they didn't pay. They were just late for a few days because they missed something.
Yeah.
So I told myself, you know what, let it be. You know, the zoo is stable. They ended up living there for 5.5 years, being late twice. I refinanced that house twice when it, you know, shot through the roof, you know, when everything went up 2005, 6, 7, before the crash. And that actually was translated into buying more properties. So that was what started is the trigger of the knowledge and kind of how I got with my first property.
I think that's a great story, Danny, because I talk to a lot of investors from around the country. They're looking to buy properties in cities that we manage in. And it really does seem like they started asking themselves very similar questions. Like, is the 401k that I'm building up, is this what's going to take me through to retirement, or is there something more? And so they start getting interested in real estate and they start their own journey and they become obsessed about it. They like literally become obsessed. And then what I've noticed is, just like you back in 2002, a lot of people, they've done enough research and it's time to take the step. And it's either you're a walker or you're a talker, right? You're either going to do it or you're not going to do it. And the most successful ones take action and do things, you know.
You know, yeah, I absolutely, absolutely agree. I've been doing it for such a long time that the benefit, I think, of doing it, it's not just the experience, but the benefit is I'm an observer of human behavior in the same category for so many years. Yeah. And some patterns only emerge maybe every 2 years. And to identify that pattern, you need to see it once or twice or three times to see that there's actually a pattern. To observe it, three incidents over so many years, that's 6 years just to see that there's a pattern. One of the two patterns that blow my mind that I've seen over the years, and this is something I think a lot of investors need to understand. First one, almost always that the 2 years mark of ownership is the eye opener to people. So someone purchased the property and then 2 years later, something happens in their understanding. Why? They've been collecting rent for about 2 years. They've been handling some of the challenges, issues, situations with tenant. You know, we all know it's never 100% quiet, buy and forget. That doesn't exist. And that's okay. It doesn't mean big drama, but stuff happens. So they got used to the ownership, dealing with the property manager, dealing with tenants, even the minimal noise that they have from the system, they got to experience it over a period of time. And now in 2 years, they're like, aha. In 2 years, they look back and say, what happened here? So I've been collecting cash flow, $500 a month, pretty consistently for the past 2 years. Maybe the value of my house even appreciated a bit. Yep. By 20,000, by 30,000, you know, maybe more, depending on, you know, what we're doing. And all of a sudden they look back and say, 2 years, how much time did I spend over this property? Maybe an hour a month on average, maybe two, I don't know, you know, maybe half an hour. And then all this money started accumulating, right? Trickling in, but all of a sudden it's a bigger chunk. And then there's an aha moment. It's not too bad. It works. And then the other thing that comes, once they have this realization, they start saying, wait. I spend, 20 hours, 30 hours in the past 2 years. That's it. And I've gained $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 combined between cash flow. And that's like amazing number. Plus I'm seeing where I'm heading, right? You know, in the future. And the next thing that usually happens is that the entire household is realigned. They don't even plan for it. All of a sudden they're saying, wait, if this was such a good investment, maybe I should do another one like this. Oh, how can I do another one if I don't have enough money? Okay, let's realign. Sometimes I see couples, they're not even intentionally sitting down and realigning. Some do, most right. don't.
Right.
But they have the realization, and then there's a realignment in the prioritization of the household finances. And then they say, one, even if it's not amazing, it's still a good one, right? It doesn't have to be an amazing... You know what? My story in Phoenix of a house that I bought for 100, less than 130, doubling in 2 or 3 years to 300, more than doubling, right? Even 320. That's an amazing story. That I was lucky. I bought the ticket.
Sure. Yeah, right.
But better story is like this house, instead of doubling, even going up to 160 in 2 years. That's nice. And cash flow. All of a sudden, the alignment of the house is changing, whether they want it or not, because say, one, it's working. Mm-hmm. Yes, there's hiccups. Yes, there's some noise in the system, but you know, bigger picture, it's working. I need more, because they all, every one of those people can see how in 10, 15, 20 years, if they pay off the mortgage, even a 30-year mortgage, they'll pay sooner. Yeah. They have the benefit of that. Then it's going to be a super cash cow. Right now, it's not a cash cow. It's going to be a super cash cow. It just needs to get there. That's amazing. Amazes me every time, you know, all over again.
That reminds me of this progression with money, right? So step one is, or stage one is, we make money. Stage two is we learn how to keep money. We're not every dime is going out the door.
Correct.
And then stage three, which is what you're talking about, the realignment of the family. Stage three is growing money.
Yeah.
And that's what you're talking about. So once people see that, hey, our passive investment, right, that we're not spending a whole bunch of time dealing with, is growing in equity. We're paying down the debt. It's appreciating a little bit. And we have some cash flow. Yes, we have some maintenance issues every once in a while. But yeah, I agree. I think that's a really good
some
picture.
Sometimes I want to kind of, you know, kind of talk sense into people and tell them, you know what? Investing in a piece of property could be one of the best thing you will do financially, not because of its own merits of just buying a property and letting it appreciate and cash flow and whatever, because exactly the side effect it does on your household. We're all running around crazy, busy, you know, people, kids, family, job, you know, everything, life, and that's okay. But we're always worried, especially as adults with kids, about our finances in the near future, so to speak, and the far future. Mm-hmm. And the effect a rental property does on people's psyche, it works. It's true. It can happen. Yes, dealing with property manager is not always easy, but big picture, it works. That has such a significant impact on people's understanding what is the right thing to do and how to go about it. You know what? Some of them may come to a realization that it's not, maybe real estate is not their flavor. Mm-hmm. But it still has the financial impact on their life. Like,
right.
Something clicked there. And I don't see a lot of things happen, you know, making that happen.
Let me ask you this question, because I want to go back to the phrase where you said, you know, I had to make a decision. I'm either going to, you know, just talk about it, or I'm actually going to do it and do the wall. So, and I said that the most successful investors we see are action takers. They're doing it. So what is the difference? Like, why do you think some people have to spend so much time doing research and never take action versus those who, I mean, investing from Tel Aviv into a market you've never been in. And we have a lot of out-of-state investors that let us manage their properties that they've never even been to. So I get that. But what is the difference between like just talking about it, doing all the research and never pulling the trigger, and those that pull the trigger?
I think it comes down to, in my opinion, one thing. And that's fear. Mm. And fear can either paralyze you, or it can either drive you to get better understanding, you know, research more. I think that's what kind of the determining factor that you're asking about. And yep. I can tell you how, if it will be beneficial, how I dealt with that point specifically, because I think fear, when you are in Tel Aviv, you know, the foreigner, the Israeli investor in the US, the gaps are 10 times more. You got language gaps, time gaps, cultural gaps. You know, I always say, we all speak English, but I also speak American now. I didn't speak American before. American and English is not, you know, is a little bit different. Those codes right. are really important, right? So there's right. a lot, there's a lot of gaps, also gaps of how real estate is done here and how real estate is done here. What always helped me when I was getting started, or even throughout my career, not just when I was getting started, I call it the negative role model, okay? You know how in life they teach us a lot to have a role model in our life so we can look up to? So I decided that I need a negative role model. Negative role model for me is someone that I look up to and see what they've done and use that on what not to do. I love my parents, but my parents were very cautious with money, not a risk takers. And that was for me a role model I don't want to follow, right? In that sense, in many other senses, ethics, works, family, absolutely.
Sure. They were great.
In right. that financially, they were for me the role model of how not to work. There was someone I worked with over the years that he was a very, you know, I would always ask myself, what is this guy would have done in that situation? And anytime I'd ask myself that question, I always went, you know, in 90 or 180 degrees, because I knew that's what I call the negative role model. If he's going to go this way, this is what I think he's going to do, or my parents, this is the way I'm going. And that helped me deal with the fear. If you think that, you know, when I signed on the purchase documents in Tel Aviv, right, mm-hmm. all remotely, and I was going down the elevator with my cousin, I brought my cousin to help me with the first purchase because I didn't have enough money. And we were young guys, and I remember I put everything I had in my bank account into this deal.
Yep.
I knew the next salary is coming. I was still an employee. It's coming in a few weeks. There, you know, so I wasn't completely terrified, but we were looking at each other going down in the elevator, literally watching it, looking, and we're kind of nodding and we're like asking ourselves, what the heck have we done? Right? The fear was there.
Yeah, sure.
We didn't let it paralyze us. We actually right. channeled that fear. So I think that if someone is in the fear is paralyzing them. The best way to address fear, if you can't use the negative role model, is knowledge. Knowledge, right? I, you know, for me, when I'm facing a new challenge, what I try to do is I literally sit down and I try to write, break it down. Because a lot of investors are like, it can be overwhelming. Mm-hmm. What is your fear? Can you break it down? And then you write, okay, for example, will it rent? Okay. Do I have money to do it? Mm-hmm. Who will manage, right? You know, start, if you break it down to 10, 15, 20 questions, yes, you need to face yourself. You need to meet with yourself. Not all of us are having, it's easy for us to sit down and write those things down. Once you broke down the fear from an overwhelming kind of word to specifics, now start tackling all of those things, right? Maybe you got a list of 15 items, right? And maybe out of those 15 items, you were able to mitigate or receive an acceptable answer under your values. Right. And five are not, or not yet. That's a huge accomplishment right there, mm-hmm. because all of a sudden, this fear, which is how do you even, or risk, right? Risk, fear. Now you broke it down and now you can tackle each one, right? And if you're not doing that exercise, you are hurting yourself because you're not going to be able to break that cloud of fear, which is just so overwhelming because it's philosophical, right? Yeah. Fear is a little bit philosophical. When you break it down to questions and specifics, it becomes specific. Hopefully, you will be able to address all the questions you have that you listed. But even if you have, you know, 12 out of the 15, 10 out of 15, it's still much better a few days ago when it was all fear.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a great point because a lot of times what we do is we allow the fear just to play stories in our head and we think about them. We never write them down. So you're right. When you start writing these things down, then you start tackling them. What that does is it removes the fear of the unknown, and you're able to see it on paper and say, okay, I've got this handled. I can do this. This is what's within my control. And here are the things that I still need to go and tackle. And I think that's great advice. Hey everyone, Spencer Sutton here, and I wanted to make you aware of a great opportunity here in our Birmingham office. We are hiring a new business development manager. So this is a sales role, someone who is going to sell our property management services to out-of-state investors, local investors, and local homeowners here in Birmingham. So if this sounds like something that you would be interested in, I would love to talk to you. This position is going to be perfect for someone who is a self-starter, somebody who is results-oriented, who loves to win, who is able to communicate very well, who can negotiate, just a natural relationship builder. So if this is you, or maybe it's somebody that you know, again, I'd love to talk to you. So feel free to email me at ssutton@evernest.co. That is ssutton@evernest.co. Hope to hear from you soon. So let's talk about, you bought your first property. It became a passion for you. You moved to California. You were like, I'm going to invest. You started investing in other markets. What was the transition from buying rental properties for yourself to then helping other investors start their own journey?
When I started working with investors slowly, mm-hmm. and I saw that I'm really enjoying it. When I was in the eighth grade, that's a funny story. I don't think I ever told it. When I was ninth grade, junior high, mm-hmm. years. Yeah. So ninth grade is the graduation before you go to high school in Israel, unlike the States. So we're doing the year end play part of the graduation. And we're doing Alice in Wonderland, mm-hmm. and there's a part, what was it? The caterpillar sitting on, or the snail, I think caterpillar or snail sitting on a mushroom, and everybody comes for his advice. Maybe I'm mixing stuff, yeah. right? So yeah. it's yeah. been a few years.
I know what you're talking about. Yep.
There's a situation where everybody's seeking advice from this guy who's just sitting back and kicking back on the mushroom, right? Something like that. That's my recollection. True or not, doesn't matter. And I'm singing to myself, like, what an awesome place to be in. He's there and everybody comes to seek his advice. And I don't know why, but that stuck me like few things in life did, right? I still carried that from ninth grade.
Yeah.
And for some reason, that kind of created an idea. And I think when I started kind of seeing that investors are coming and asking for advice, maybe it is an ego thing. I think I don't carry a big one, if at all, but maybe it did pad it. Maybe it was me, kind of liking helping others, but I could see that not only that, I'm enjoying it, I'm also good at it. I'm also good with deciphering the problem, breaking down the challenges, similar to what we just talked about a minute ago.
Yep.
Addressing the concerns. It was like a challenge. I found that everybody that I work with has set of challenges, a beginner, an advanced 1031 exchange, whatever. Even sellers have challenges, right? There's always something. And then they come to me and I'm enjoying the conversation. I'm enjoying showing them the solution. I'm enjoying, all this interaction with them. And, the interesting thing to me, the best test case, when I work with investors, the first thing we do is like an intro session. I call it strategy session. And no sales pitch, no, let's talk about what your needs are, right? And if you know what? Honestly, I also want to check you out if it's a good fit, right? That's the mm-hmm. way I look at it. And in that session, I have had more than 10,000 such sessions in my career. Mm-hmm. More than 10,000, right? Maybe even much more. But, somewhere, last time I counted was 7,000, and that was about 5 years ago or 4 years ago. Even today, when I still have those sessions, I'm seeing like 10,000 sessions after. I'm still enjoying it. I'm not like, oh, here's another one. I'm like, I'm all pumped up. That always tells me I'm in the right spot with myself. Now, that's the passion of doing it. I will say, when I work with investors, I also get compensated. I earn money. I buy more real estate. So it definitely goes hand in hand. But I could go and get compensated in other areas. I'm just enjoying this. I think I'm enjoying the challenges real estate presents. I'm enjoying, the working with the investors and finding solutions. it feels good doing something that I like doing. Even sometimes like fun to see like, wow, this guy's, you know, been working with me for more than 10 years and look at all this accomplishment, right? It's like, can I really credit all that to myself or is it just part of it is me? I don't know, but it's just nice to see from the side. I mean, I am enjoying it. You know, it sounds like weird, but maybe it is.
No, I think that's great. And to tie it back to that story from ninth grade, that's great. So what are, I mean, I know that.
Yeah, I'm a caterpillar.
The caterpillar. I think it was a caterpillar on a mushroom. Sitting back, smoking a pipe. I think that's what it was in Alice in Wonderland, I think.
I think it was a real mushroom or, you know, like a stage, you know, kind of mushroom and not, you know, there was no microdosing going around.
No. There was none of that. So tell me about, I mean, I know that investors have different challenges around the country, but we are in an extremely hot market, like nationwide in different pockets. I mean, we're in Nashville, we're in Denver, we're in Atlanta, we're in Birmingham. These are all very extremely hot markets. What are the challenges that you're seeing your students facing finding properties in a market like this?
So obviously, I can tell you that in my career of almost, you know, 20 years, I've never seen such a market, right? Never. Mm-hmm. Like the supply demand is off the chart. And that's obviously the biggest challenge is finding properties or suitable or investable properties and acquiring them, right? The biggest challenge or competition are homeowners nowadays. Well, let's just say, first of all, we have multiple players in the playground. Yeah. We got the homeowners that are approximately 2/3 of the owners in the United States are homeowners, right? Mm-hmm. 1/3 is investment properties, just about, right? You know, generally speaking, right? Now, in this 1/3, so first of all, homeowners have a lot of advantage because the rates they're getting for mortgages are much better than we are getting, especially starting April of this year. So they have an easier time. Homeowners are also driven by FOMO very powerfully these days.
Right.
Just because this is their 5th, 7th, 10th offer and they're losing again. So by the 11th ones, they're not going to make 20,000 over, 30,000 over. They're going to make even more, right? So they're driven and they're measuring it by affordability. Rate is low. I can afford the 250,000, 300, whatever, 200. And we investors are very much ROI driven. I am rent driven, right? And I can absorb a little bit, along the way or calculate things and maybe a little bit different, but at some point, if it's less than breaking even, I may not want to even touch that house, right? I'm not even saying that I would want it. So that's the biggest challenge for competing with the biggest buying power here, which are homeowners.
Right.
Within the investment, investment portion of 1/3, we see the institutions really came into our playground around the crash of 2008. Wall Street money was not really present before the crash. The crash changed things, and then now obviously they're coming with big bucks and it's hard to compete with, right? You know, you said it in the beginning, I think you said it earlier, you mentioned it earlier. The competition with the institution, with other investors, with homeowners on a tight inventory, that's the biggest challenge for all the investors. I tell my investors, first of all, be patient. We may need to submit 10 offers. Mm-hmm. We may need to submit 15 offers. We may be able to do it in 2 weeks. It may take us 3 months. But we're going to make a correct decision. We're not going to rush in. And that's okay. In my entire career, I never had an investor except once that was really, and obviously not 1031, that are really like, we have to do it quickly, right? It did happen for personal reasons, actually more than once, but very rarely. So normally they're very cool, but that's the challenge. That's the challenge, you know. And then in my world of real estate, we're even, I would say it's even narrower because we are so picky. The age, the size, the school, the street, the power lines, too close. I can look at the map of Nashville, start a search for properties, and it shows 500 properties. When I'm done with filtering, I may have 10 to 15 properties. And even out of those 10, 15, half or more are not relevant, and almost the rest are under contract or something like that.
Right.
So that's challenging. That's very, very challenging. So inventory, there's no doubt. Inventory, very hard.
Yeah. And in this market, I mean, and even within the investment community, you have so much competition. But I think your point is a very great point. It is be patient, and stick to your buy box. Like create your buy box and then don't stray. Just be patient and you will find deals. Like there are still investors buying deals in these markets. I know we've helped several.
You know what? I looked at our system to track how many properties we have under contract just the other day. And in my mind, we're struggling because in my mind, like I'm thinking about day to day and I'm like, oh, another one didn't get, and another one didn't. And that's just what goes into my mind. And then I opened our CRM system to see what's going on in the pipeline. I'm like, ooh, wow. I guess the efforts of that I'm doing, we're all doing as a system are working. My pipeline looks good, right? I never trust the pipeline 100% because things change and we had a cancellation yesterday. Right. And I'm always, you know, kind of nervous about it. But compared to what I thought we are and what I'm seeing my pipeline for the next, in closing for the next 2 months, thank God, you know, because it's crazy. I've been working, you know, for many years. And this is the first time in my history that I have tons of buyers and very low inventory relatively, right? If there is more, you know, balance, I would be making more deals right now, but it's always one or the other. And all of a sudden, a lot of buyers and less inventory. And I'm like, finally we're here. And it's kind of annoying, but the pipeline looks good, knock on wood. Yeah.
Well, that's good. I mean, I was buying houses in 04, 05, 06, and we thought it was a hot market. And it was a hot market, but nothing like today.
Nothing like this. In 04, 05, 06, you had inventory.
You had inventory, market, that's right.
But you weren't struggling for inventory. Now, the biggest challenge on my end, inventory. And I'm doing a lot of things to mitigate that, to help the teams, you know, in the field. That's the challenge. You know, a lot of creativity, a lot of work, a lot of hours spent on evaluating, digesting, only to realize it's not a good transaction. It is a good transaction, etc. Yeah.
Well, awesome. Well, Danny, this has been great. I mean, I would love, like, how can people connect with you online? What is the best way for our listeners to reach out to you?
If you didn't get it by now, my web identity is Simply Do It. Everywhere you would go and put Simply Do It or Simply Do It Real Estate, you'll probably, you know, will be reaching me through the different social media out there. Mm-hmm. The website is simplydoit.net.
Okay.
And you can email us at meet@simplydoit.net. We quick to respond. We happy to talk to investors. I'm not a very good salesperson. So, you know, no sales pitch. And I do like to talk to people first to see if there's a good fit. If there's not a good fit, that's okay. No problem. I mean, no courses pitch, no, you know, books and tapes kind of a pitch. Let's just see. Our core business is investing and helping investors invest in real estate. You know, everything else is supplementary. That's the core.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, I was on Danny's website earlier before we got on, and there's a lot of great information. So I encourage you to check it out, simplydoit.net. So Danny, man, thanks for being on the show. It's been great to meet you, and I wish you all the best. Everyone, if you have not subscribed yet, go ahead and subscribe to our podcast. We would love for you to review our podcast. It's a great way for people to find us on iTunes. So until next time, we'll be back with another episode of the Birmingham Real Estate Investor Podcast.